Welcome. This is Divine. This is episode 500 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK and Step 3 exams. And this is going to be series 108. This is a very meaningful podcast. And I feel like a lot of people have gotten a lot of benefit from this podcast over the years. And I'm just truly grateful to God for how far we have come. Thinking back to when I made episode 1, and now this is basically 500 episodes later. I'm just really grateful for the impact that this podcast has made in many people's lives. So today, the game plan is to make this a pretty high-yield rapid review to go over a lot of very pertinent stuff for the USMLE exams. And the thing that's going to happen is I'm going to try to spend some time, really going into some things that are probably fall under the more technical aspect of things for people. But again, I think you're going to get a lot from this, like you have from many of the other podcasts that I have made. Okay, so let's start off with a few questions on cardiac pressure. So what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that 2 weeks ago, this patient had a lot of rhinorrhea, and had some, had a productive cough, but that now this person, over the last 2 days, his legs have swollen, and you're told that he has been having shortness of breath, and that he now requires like 2 or 3 pillows to sleep comfortably at night. And then you're told that on cardiac auscultation, you can hear a lot of pulmonary crackles, and you can hear a new S3 heart sound. If you see something like this, first things first, what's going on? Well, this person clearly has viral myocarditis. What's the thing that tells us this is viral myocarditis? Again, you see recent URI symptoms, and then after that, you're seeing heart failure symptoms. You're seeing a lot of crackles in the lungs. You're seeing evidence of peripheral edema. You're seeing an S3 heart sound. Remember, an S3 heart sound many times on the USMLEs is code word for systolic dysfunction. This person has heart failure symptoms. It's going to be viral myocarditis. And again, what causes viral myocarditis? There are many causes of viral myocarditis, but on your exams, the big one you want to think about is Coxsackie B, right? And if you do a biopsy of these people's hearts, you're going to see inflammatory infiltration of their heart. Again, a good number of these people completely recover with time, but you're going to treat them the way you're going to treat heart failure. So again, you see heart failure symptoms after a URI. I want you to think of Coxsackie B, viral myocarditis. Now, in terms of cardiac pressures, right? So let's assume they're trying to ask you to imagine what the portal pressures will look like in this person, what the hepatic venous pressures will look like in this person, what the jugular venous pressures will look like in this person, what the central venous pressure will look like in this person, what the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure will look like in this person. So let's kind of put all these things together. What would they look like? So the thing is, if a person has viral myocarditis, their hearts are not working. It's literally not working. So since their heart, their left ventricle, their right ventricle, things like that are not doing very well, blood is going to start backing up in the heart. So all the cardiac pressures will be elevated. The pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, which is a surrogate for left atrial pressure, is going to be elevated. Why? Because again, remember, by the way, left atrial pressure and pulmonary capillary wedge pressure are pretty much the same thing, right? The reason it's called pulmonary capillary wedge pressure is because the pressures are measured by wedging something in the pulmonary capillaries, and then it gives you a surrogate of the left atrial pressure. Many of us know this as the Swan-Ganz catheter, okay? So whenever you see the term pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, it's a surrogate on your exams for like pulmonary venous and left atrial pressures. So these people are going to have increases in their left atrial pressures. That is very, very high yield to know for your exams, because again, their left ventricle is not contracting. So blood is going to back up in the left atrium. So it's going to be increased. Okay, but think about it as well. These people's hearts are not contracting well. So since blood is backing up in the left atrium, it's going to back up in every other part of the heart. So they're going to have backup as well in the right atrium. So their central venous pressure, which is a surrogate for the right atrial pressure, will also be increased as well. Remember, your right atrium is where most of the veins in your body ultimately drain into. So since that's where most of the veins in your body ultimately drain into, your right atrium is like a central hub for your veins. That's why right atrial pressure is also called central venous pressure. So these people's central venous pressure is going to be elevated. Okay, so what's going to happen to their jugular venous pressure? Well, their jugular venous pressure is going to be elevated as well. These people are going to have jugular venous distension. Why? Because again, the SVC and the IVC, right? More especially the SVC, cannot drain properly into the heart. So these people are going to have jugular venous distension. And then what's going to be true of their portal pressures and their hepatic venous pressures? Well, I would hope you're saying, wow, Divine, those things are both going to be elevated as well. Because again, if your heart is not pumping well, fluid is going to back up into your IVC, and then it's going to back up. Because remember, your hepatic vein is what ultimately becomes the inferior vena cava. So these people are going to have an increase in their hepatic venous pressures, and their portal pressures are going to be elevated as well. If they want to be weird with you on your exams, how can they make a hepatic venous or portal pressure question hard? Instead of calling it hepatic venous pressure or portal pressure, like portal vein pressure, they can just call it liver sinusoidal pressure. They can literally just call it liver sinusoidal pressure. Again, that's a very classic pathway taken by the USMLEs. They'll take what you know and just express it in somewhat different terms that are closely related but are not exactly that thing that you're looking for. So just be mindful of that. That's why understanding really does matter on these exams. So, because remember, your portal vein, ultimately, if you look at the way the portal system works, your portal vein is going to drain ultimately into some sinusoidal capillaries. And then those sinusoidal capillaries are then going to ultimately drain into your hepatic vein. And then your hepatic vein is what's going to create your inferior vena cava, right? That's why the liver is called a portal system. A portal system is basically when you have a system of capillaries that are fed by a kind of vessel and drained by the exact same kind of vessel. I'm going to say that again. A portal system is formed by a capillary network that is fed by a certain kind of vessel and is drained by the same kind of vessel. By kind of vessel, I mean an artery or a vein. For example, the liver has sinusoidal capillaries. Those sinusoidal capillaries can be fed by a network of veins. Those are the portal veins. And then those sinusoidal capillaries are drained by a network of veins. That's the hepatic vein, right? That's why it's a portal venous system. If you're looking for another portal system, go and check the kidneys. The kidneys have an arterial portal system, right? The glomerular capillaries are fed by the afferent arteriole. Because normally, if you go all over the body, capillaries are fed by arterioles and drained by venules. But that is not the case in the kidneys. The glomerular capillaries are fed by the afferent arterioles, and the glomerular capillaries are drained by the efferent arterioles. That's an arterial portal system, right? The next place you can find another portal system is if you go up to the hypothalamus. I'll let you kind of do the research on that on your own. But basically, most times you invent portal systems in the body when you want to really regulate how things move around. When you have a capillary system that has a lot of regulation with it, or an arterial or a venous system with a lot of regulation, you love to put those things around portal systems. Just something I kind of want to throw in there. Kind of a useful point to know for exams, right? So again, hepatic venous pressures, portal pressures will be elevated for this person that has viral myocarditis. And if you really think about it, they are liver sinusoidal pressures, right? Because the sinusoids are a go-between between the portal vein that feed them and the hepatic vein that drains them. So just something to kind of keep at the back of your mind for exams. Okay, what if they give you a question about a patient? And they tell you that this patient is a 45-year-old male. And, you know, for the past 6 months, he has had a lot of pruritus. And they tell you that he has this plethoric appearance to his skin. And then you're told that this person, over the last 24 hours, he has been having progressively worsening abdominal pain and swelling. And then they tell you that this person has a fluid wave, right? They have a fluid wave on palpation of the abdomen, right? And you're told, you're giving some labs, this person's white blood cell count is like 7,000, so that's normal. The person's platelet count is like 550,000, so a little bit elevated. But this person's hematocrit is like 75%. That's super elevated. Clearly, this person has polycythemia vera. And that polycythemia vera has led to Budd-Chiari syndrome. Budd-Chiari syndrome. Remember, in Budd-Chiari syndrome, you have thrombosis of the hepatic vein. When you thrombose the hepatic vein, everything that is proximal to it, blood is going to back up in those things. So those people are going to have an increase in their hepatic venous pressures. They're going to have portal congestion. They're going to have an increase in their liver sinusoidal pressures. They're going to have an increase in their portal venous pressures. If your portal venous pressures increase, especially if it's a high-grade obstruction, you can develop ascites very, very rapidly. Although, it's not everyone that has Budd-Chiari syndrome that develops ascites. They can just have very sharp, very significant right upper quadrant pain. Again, you're going to see it in a person that is predisposed to Budd-Chiari syndrome, like a person that has polycythemia vera, or a person that has PNH, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. But let's focus on the person that has P-Vera. Why would a person develop? Because it's something you may have heard many times that, oh, people that have polycythemia vera, you know, they have a very high risk of thrombotic episodes. Well, why may that be the case? Well, it all comes down to this. It all comes down to the fact that these people's blood is very viscous. Whenever you have something that is viscous, that thing does not flow as well. It's like, for example, think about it. If you're trying to pour water out of a jug versus you're trying to pour oil or like grease out of a jug, the grease is gonna flow slower because it's a more viscous fluid. Just think, try to think about it intuitively. Let's not make this thing more complex than it needs to be, right? So the thing is, normally a person's hematocrit, especially for a guy, should be like under like 45% or thereabouts. Again, I'm just giving rough numbers. You can look up the exact numbers in your own time. But a hematocrit of 75%, that tells you that this person's hemoglobin is like 25. That's really high. That's really, really high. Whenever your blood is that viscous, it is not going to flow very well. And think about it. If blood is not flowing very well, what's going to happen? Ask yourself, what's going to happen? You're going to have blood stasis. What does blood stasis sound like that you've probably heard of before? It sounds like something that comes out of a Verco's Triad movie. Remember, in Verco's Triad, you have stasis, you have hypercoagulability, and you have endothelial dysfunction. That blood that is not as viscous is going to be more static. Because it's more static, is going to have a higher risk of forming thrombi and emboli, and the person can get in trouble. This is why people that have polycythemia vera, they have a very, very high risk of thrombotic episodes. They can get strokes, they can get myocardial infarctions, they can get PEs, they can get DVTs. But in this case, we're focusing more on the Budd-Chiari syndrome that he can get, thrombosis of the hepatic vein. That's why they have all these problems, okay? And I guess as another tidbit I can kind of throw in for you, before I start talking about the pressures, you may wonder, why is it that people that have P-Vera, why is it that many of them tend to be hypertensive? Well, again, think about it. It all goes back to Poiseuille's law. That's a wonderful way they can take the stuff that you've learned from step one and throw it on a step two and a step three exam. That's a very simple way they can accomplish those goals. Why? Because if you think about it, total peripheral resistance is directly proportional to the length of the vessel. It's directly proportional to the viscosity, right? And it's inversely related to the radius to the fourth power. So if you think about it this way, this person has blood that is very viscous. So because the person has blood that is incredibly viscous, the total peripheral resistance is going to go up. And if that total peripheral resistance goes up, then that's going to make it hard for blood to flow. That's going to cause the vessels to be congested. So the person's blood pressure is going to be high. In fact, to be honest with you, this is probably going to be one of those rapid reviews that I'm going to label as a rapid review for step one all the way to step three. Because there are just many things that I imagine the step one taker will find to be quite helpful in this podcast. So let's go ahead and continue. So what is going to be true of this person's hepatic venous pressure? Well, this person's hepatic venous pressure is clearly going to be elevated, right? Because the hepatic vein is blocked. So the hepatic venous pressure is going to be elevated. What's going to be true of the liver sinusoidal pressures? Going to be elevated as well. Because again, all these things come before the obstruction, right? What's going to be true of the portal venous pressure? It's going to be elevated as well, right? But ask yourself, what's going to be true of these people's jugular venous pressure? The jugular venous pressure is going to be normal because again, the blockade is in the hepatic vein. So blood is not really flowing into the inferior vena cava as much anymore. So these people are not going to have jugular venous distension. That's one. Another thing you're going to notice is that all their cardiac pressures are going to be low, right? So their left atrial pressure, which is the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, is going to be low or normal. And the right atrial pressure, which is the central venous pressure, is also going to be low or normal. You may wonder, Divine, why would this be normal if I'm not sending blood to the heart? Well, this may be normal because, again, remember, there are all these other things that can send blood to the heart through different pathways. Just something you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? But it'll be low or it'll be normal. It'll be low or it'll be normal. Okay, now let's give another situation. What if they give you a question about a person? Let's say it's a female and she's like 38 years old and she smokes and she's on OCPs and she has this sudden onset shortness of breath, right? And you're told that she has this sudden jugular venous distension that develops. What's going on there? I would hope you're saying, oh, Divine, this sounds an awful lot like a pulmonary embolus, which it is. This person literally has a PE, right? Again, if you kind of think about the backdrop here, this person is over 35 and they smoke. And then they're on OCPs. These people are pretty much like begging for a pulmonary embolus. Well, again, remember, if you have a pulmonary embolus, what is being occluded? It's going to be in your pulmonary vessels, especially your pulmonary arteries or your pulmonary capillaries. That's where the obstruction is going to be, right? So again, whenever you're getting these cardiac pressure questions, the smart place, ask yourself, where is the roadblock? And then ask yourself, everything before the roadblock is going to have higher pressures. Everything after the roadblock is going to have low or normal pressures. Low or normal pressures after the roadblock. So what are the things that come before the roadblock? Well, the things that come before the roadblock are things like your right ventricle, your right atrium, your hepatic vein, your portal vein, your liver sinusoids. So all those things are going to have elevated pressures, right? So your liver sinusoidal pressures, portal pressures, hepatic venous pressures, jugular venous pressures, central venous pressures, which is a surrogate for the right atrial pressure, those things are all going to be elevated. But everything that comes distal is going to be normal or decreased, right? Like your pulmonary capillary wedge pressure is going to be diminished. In fact, if we throw in a few more things, what's going to be true of these people's cardiac output? The cardiac output is going to be low, right? Because venous return for the left atrium is diminished. And if we were to see an acute kidney injury in these people, what kind of acute kidney injury would they likely have? They will likely have a pre-renal acute kidney injury. Why? Because again, their kidneys are completely fine. The kidney is just not getting enough gas. The kidney is not being perfused adequately. So these people are going to have a pre-renal acute kidney injury, which on your exam they can call a pre-renal isotemia. In fact, they can make another question out of this. What will be true of these people's urine osmolarity? Their urine osmolarity is going to be extremely high because the body sees that, wow, gee, this person is not perfusing the kidneys very well. So since you're not perfusing the kidneys, well, your afferent arterial, the JG cells are going to freak out. They're going to make a ton of renin. You're going to convert angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 is going to be converted to angiotensin 2. And then angiotensin 2 is going to go to the hypothalamus and cause you to release ADH. When you release that ADH, it's going to cause you to reabsorb a ton of water from your urine. So urine is going to be very, very concentrated, right? Again, you can see how the USMLEs can test material in many different dimensions. Okay, what if they give you a question about a person, last 3 days, person has been coughing up a lot, having a lot of shortness of breath, is not able to take many steps without feeling short of breath, and they give you like a chest x-ray, and you notice that, man, this person's lungs are huge, and this person's like 70-something years old, and this person has smoked like 2 packs of cigarettes per day since they were 30, right? This person probably has like an 80-pack-year smoking history or something ridiculous. Obviously, this person has like a COPD, right? This person probably has core pulmonale. Remember, our friends at the USMLEs, they really love this term of core pulmonale, where you pretty much develop right heart failure from a pulmonary cause. Because if you think about it, what is the most common cause of right heart failure? It is left heart failure. Left heart failure is, in fact, the most common cause of right heart failure. But you can have right heart failure because you have a pulmonary issue like cystic fibrosis or COPD or idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis or something like that. That's called core pulmonale. When you have core pulmonale, you have pulmonary hypertension. So again, you can already imagine that, oh, gee, wait, Divine, all the labs you said for a person that has a large PE will literally be the exact same labs you see for a person, or arrows you see for a person that has core pulmonale. Again, that's pretty high yield to make sure you know and understand for exams. And again, if you love this multidimensional thinking, and let's say, or teaching, and let's say you're studying for step 1 or step 2 or step 3, I have a bunch of classes coming up next month. I have a separate podcast on that, so I'm not going to spend time belaboring that. But all my classes are pretty much based on scenarios. I use scenarios, and then I really help you understand pathophase. So I'm not just throwing information at you. And again, those scenarios are presented in exam-like formats, like a way we'll likely present on an exam. So you're actually getting a lot from that. And then you're also going to see how things integrate across multiple disciplines. Starting on the 8th of January, I have a step one class. It's a 25-hour class. It's for people taking step one or complex one. Or if you're taking step two or step three or complex two or three, and you have a poor step one foundation, the class will be perfect for you. And then I have a series of other classes during the month of January. I have a 5-hour social sciences class for step one to step three, a 4-hour biostats class for step one to step three, and I have an MBME test taking strategies class as well for step one to step three. And then I have a 20-hour step two, step three review. And I also have a 100-hour step two, step three class actually taking place in May. If you're interested in any of these classes, listen to the podcast I made where I talked about them, or just shoot me an email and I can give you some more information. Okay, so let's go ahead and continue. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient? They tell you that this person is brought to the clinic by his wife because she has noticed he has passed out 4 times over the last week. And you're told that he has passed out every time that he was urinating, that the inciting event seemed to be urination, and he will urinate, and then a few seconds after his urinary stream starts, this person completely passes out. So you see that presentation, right? What should you be thinking about? What should you be thinking about? So here's the thing. Our friends at the USMLEs, they can supply many different kinds of answers for this problem on your exam. If they want to be nice, they can call it like micturition-induced syncope, which makes sense. Person was peeing, they syncopized. Now, what are some other ways they can present this answer on exams? They can call this vasovagal syncope. They can call this overactive carotid reflex. There are many things they can call this, right? So you may be like, Divine, how do all these things relate? Well, first things first, this person has vasovagal syncope, right? But let's talk about how all these things kind of come together, right? The thing is, the USMLEs, they love to test the kinds of syncope. And the one that they love to test a lot is vasovagal syncope. Now, here's the thing. There are many ways that vasovagal syncope can present on your exams. It can present as a person that, before they pass out, their face turns white. Right, they have facial pallor, and you also notice that this person is sweating a ton, and then they pass out. That's one way they can test vasovagal syncope. But another way they can test vasovagal syncope is in the context of situations. And what are the situations they love to test? They love to test situations that increase pressures on your carotid arteries. Right? Like, think about it again. You can go to a restroom, sit on the toilet, and try to pee with force. If you pee with force, do you notice that your neck kind of tenses up? That tensing up of your neck is literally compressing the carotid artery. If you have an overactive carotid baroreceptor reflex, that's going to, because when you press on your carotids that hard, when you press on it that hard, then your carotid baroreceptor starts to fire like crazy. It tricks the body into thinking that, this person's blood pressure is elevated. So your body's like, I need to send a parasympathetic discharge to the heart to lower the blood pressure. So you send this parasympathetic discharge to the heart. It's going to cause profound bradycardia. It's going to cause a profound decrease in cardiac output. And that can cause you to become syncopal. Can make you syncopize, right? So the thing is, that's the concept. But again, the way you get to that concept, again, the USMLEs, you can almost imagine that they can go in many different directions with this. They can give you a person that passes out while peeing, right? That's vasovagal syncope. They can give you a question about a person that passes out while pooping. That's also vasovagal syncope. Again, think about it, right? I'm not saying poop on yourself, but again, if you're trying to poop really hard as you poop, you're exerting all those pressures. You're going to be tensing up on your neck. You're going to be increasing your intrathoracic pressures. All those things are going to compress your carotid arteries. You're going to get in trouble, right? Obviously, it's not everyone that does that that gets in trouble, but people that have overactive reflexes can get in that trouble. Or if they give you a question about a person that syncopizes while they're in labor, they can literally make that an OB-GYN shelf question, or they can make that just a straight up USMLE question. Again, it's going to be from parasympathetic stimulation of the heart. Because again, if you're in labor and you're pushing, oh, push, push, as you're pushing that hard, right? Your neck is going to tense up. You're going to compress the carotids. You're going to get in trouble, right? Another way they can even apply this principle is they can tell you about a person that's wearing a necktie. And they tell you that this person keeps syncopizing whenever they wear a necktie. So they've stopped wearing neckties. Well, guess what? If you're wearing a necktie and you tie it too tight, right? Again, you can have this extrinsic compression of the carotid artery. If you compress the carotid artery, you're going to stimulate that baroreceptor reflex. You're going to get a parasympathetic discharge. You're going to pass out. Right. So again, you can see that there are many ways they can test this concept. I mean, think about it. Why do you think that many times if you try to poop really hard, you start feeling a little nauseous, a little dizzy? Well, it's because, again, you're having that parasympathetic discharge to the heart. Right. So and even why do you think we tell people, why do you think we massage the carotids in people that have supraventricular tachycardias? It's for that reason. Because again, if you massage the carotids, you're stimulating those carotid baroreceptors. That's going to cause the heart, that's going to cause the brain to send a parasympathetic discharge to the heart. It's going to slow conduction down the AV node. That's going to break that tachyarrhythmia, right? Or you may wonder, why do we tell these people to blow into a straw? Again, it's for that same reason. It's for that same reason. If you blow into a straw, think about it. Think of yourself blowing a balloon. That's like doing like a Valsalva. Again, don't do it, because if you do it well enough, you could actually pass out. I'm not saying please. So FYI, this podcast is just for educational purposes. This is not for clinical decision making or anything like that, right? I'm putting out that disclaimer. Before you do anything, consult with your physician, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so when you blow into a straw, right? Again, you're raising your intrathoracic pressures. You're raising the pressures in your neck. You're compressing those carotids. You're going to get a massive parasympathetic discharge to the heart. You're going to slow conduction on the AV node. That's going to terminate that person's tachyarrhythmia. Okay, it's going to terminate that person's tachyarrhythmia. Again, you can see all these things. They just love to test it on exams. And again, how do we diagnose vasovagal syncope? You're going to do a tilt table test. You're going to diagnose it with a tilt table test. Okay, you're going to diagnose it with a tilt table test. Right. Again, these are all high yield things you want to make sure you know very well for your exams. Okay. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient and they tell you that, let's see, how do I frame this question? So they tell you that this patient is a newborn, and this newborn was born at like 31 weeks gestation, and this person has profound respiratory distress. I know many of you are like, oh, Divine, boohoo, this is respiratory distress syndrome. Of course, yeah, I know you know that. That's not the concern here. But let's talk about arrows that they can throw in with this, right? In fact, this is almost like an arrow podcast, right? What are the arrows they can throw in with this? Okay, right. So first things first, we know you see a child, they have respiratory distress and they're born prematurely. It's probably going to be from respiratory distress syndrome. It's pretty straightforward. It's going to be pretty straightforward. Okay, so what are the arrows they can test with this stuff? Well, the first arrow they can test is compliance. What happens to your lung compliance? Okay, well, think about this. When you're born that early, you don't have enough surfactant. Remember, surfactant, by the way, is made by your type 2 pneumocytes. Again, you may think that this is only something they care about for step 1. Until you take step 2 or step 3 and you see this as a question and you're like, whoa, where did that come from? Well, that's where it came from. You got to know this stuff for your exams. Okay, so surfactant is made by your type 2 pneumocytes. So if you have a surfactant deficiency, normally what surfactant does is that it reduces surface tension. 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 So because surface tension wants your lungs to collapse. So if you're reducing surface tension, you're going to make it harder for the lungs to collapse. You're going to make it easier for the lungs to be kept open. So think about it. Since these people lack surfactant, they're going to have increased surface tension. So because they have increased surface tension, the lungs are more likely to collapse. Because they are more likely to collapse, they are less likely to expand. So because they are less likely to expand, what do you think is going to happen to the compliance? The lung compliance is going to go down. The lung compliance is going to go down. That's very high yield to know. The lung compliance is going to go down. Okay, what's going to happen to the elastance of the person's lungs? Well, the elastance of their lungs is going to increase. Well, there are two ways you can think about this. Compliance and elastance are inversely related. So obviously, if your compliance is going down, then your elastance is going to be going up. But elastance is just a measure of your ability to snap back. So if you're not very good at expanding, because you have increased surface tension. You're going to have an increased ability to snap back. So that means your elastance is going to be going up. Your elastance is going to be going up. Okay. And then to another way they can even test this compliance thing is they can test it instead of putting compliance as one of the arrows. They can just put volume. They can just put volume increase for a defined pressure change, right? You're going to have a smaller volume increase with applying the same amount of pressure if your lungs are not very compliant. Again, because remember, compliance is volume over pressure. Compliance is volume over pressure. So because these people's lungs are more likely to collapse, you're going to need higher pressures to obtain the same kind of volume increase compared to a normal situation where you have adequate amounts of surfactant. Again, be careful. I'm telling you this. I don't know why I'm repeating this a lot to cap off the year. But the USMLEs, it's a big thing they do these days. They take what you know and explain it out in a Q-step or explain it out as an answer choice. And then you see people begin to massively struggle with those things, even if they've memorized all the Anki decks known to mankind. So just be kind of careful about that. Okay, what's another thing they can ask? They can ask about collapsing pressures of the alveoli. What would be true of the collapsing pressures of the alveoli in a person that has neonatal respiratory distress syndrome? Well, clearly, the collapsing pressures are going to be increased. The collapsing pressures are going to be increased because, again, that surface tension is increased. Okay, now let me ask you this. What will be true of these people's lung volumes? Would they be operating at high lung volumes or they be operating at low lung volumes? Or they're going to be operating at low lung volumes because, again, their lungs have an increased tendency to collapse. Their lungs have an increased tendency to collapse. So their lungs are going to be operating at lower lung volumes. And again, they can just throw in some volume just to mess with your head. They can give you a question about like functional residual capacity or residual volume or whatever. Those things are going to be low. Okay. Those things are going to be low. This is why many of these kids, you know, you're going to treat them with, you know, you're going to give them surfactant, right? And many of them are going to need oxygen therapy because you want to keep the lungs open. You're counteracting many of these problems with increased surface tension in these people's lungs. Now, one tidbit I think I'm going to throw in, you know, since this is a rapid review series, I may kind of stop this here soon. But one thing they may throw in, you may see a child that is born at term and has neonatal respiratory distress syndrome. And then they may ask you a somewhat unique question. They will say, this patient's pregnancy and delivery was most likely associated with which of the following maternal medical histories. And they'll put a bunch of things. They'll put hypertension, they'll put diabetes, they can put like heart failure, they can put like a bunch of stuff, they can put like full maternal folate deficiency, they can put exposure to a cat litter or something ridiculous, right? If you see this, I would really hope you're saying, oh, Divine, I'm going to pick diabetes as the answer. So I want to say something here before I address this concept. This is actually more like a testing principle, or just to give you an idea of how the USMLEs love to test information. One classic way the USMLEs love to test information in this day and age is that they'll write a question on some pathology. You'll be reading a question, you're like, oh, I know exactly what this is. But then they will ask almost like a bizarre Q-stem and put bizarre answers. Like they'll give you a pathology and say, oh, this person most likely has which of the following medical histories? Or this person most likely will have which of the following findings on physical exam? Or this person will have which of the following findings in XYZ? Or which of the following things on exam make it more likely that this person has this disease and not this, right? So you see a child born at term and they have neonatal respiratory distress syndrome. And then you're being asked, for the evaluation or this pregnancy, labor and delivery process is most likely as related with the following, which of the following maternal medical histories. And again, sorry, I'm kind of coming off with this up the top of my head. But you're going to pick the answer that says diabetes. You're going to pick the answer that says diabetes. So how does diabetes tie into neonatal respiratory distress syndrome? Well, the link is being an infant of a diabetic mom, right? So think about if your mom has diabetes, she has high blood glucose. Well, as the fetus, you're going to get access to that high blood glucose. Well, the fetus is going to be like, man, I don't like having this high blood glucose problem. It's not very good. I don't like this at all. So what's this fetus going to do? This fetus is going to be like, you know what? Beta cells, let's undergo hyperplasia so I can make a ton of insulin. And then that insulin, that high insulin will help us deal with the blood glucose problems that we're getting from mom. Well, one of the things that insulin does is insulin inhibits surfactant production, right? Surfactant is not going to be produced well when you have hyperinsulinemia. But this fetus has hyperinsulinemia. So guess what? This fetus is going to be predisposed to neonatal respiratory distress syndrome. So if you see a child that is born at term and has NRDS, because most times NRDS is going to be in a preterm child. But you see a child, this child is born at term, and child has NRDS. That child is almost, I'm not going to say guaranteed, no, but very likely that child is the child of a mom that has diabetes. That's an infant of a diabetic mom, right? I'm telling you, infants of diabetic moms, there are so many things they can test with those on exams. They can test polyhydramnios with that on exams, right? Because that child has hyperglycemia, so they're going to have glucosuria. They're going to pee a ton. They're going to have polyhydramnios. That's another way they can go with that on exams. Right? So there are just many things they can go with an infant of a diabetic mom, right? Or that child may need a C-section, right? Because the child is too big. The risk of cephalopelvic disproportion is too high. So those kids have to be delivered by C-section, right? They're not going to fit in the pelvis, right? So, or they can even give you a shoulder dystocia question, right? They can give you herb Duchenne palsy, right? And they can ask, oh, what maternal medical history? Again, I'm just trying to tie all these things back. Oh, what maternal medical history most likely increase this child risk of XYZ, right? Again, it's going to be that diabetes history. Okay, I think I should go ahead and stop here. This is going on almost 40 minutes. But again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one to step three, and preclinical exams, third year shelf exams. And I also tutor for some of these residency exams, right? Like the internal medicine boards. I do certainly tutor for that. Internal medicine boards, family medicine boards, I tutor for those exams. And then again, I have review courses for all the USMLEs and all the Comlex exams. I have this podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. I have a YouTube channel you can check out. That's where I have the videos that I have. And then I also have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. Many of you know I'm a Christian. So every week I post two podcasts, and from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. We actually have 240 episodes. I made the 240th one this morning. So there's actually an Apple podcast associated with that. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So check that out. I think you're going to get a lot of benefit from it. Now, the one thing I'm just going to say, you know, this is episode 500. I think it's a reasonable episode to give a life lesson. But honestly, my life lesson to you today is just going to be to be patient. Be patient. Many people make mistakes in their lives because they're just not patient. You can trace many issues of people's lives to not being patient. You see people losing their tempers because they're not patient. You see people not getting enough from their dedicated period because they're not patient. Because a patient person is going to have a lot of staying power. If you have a lot of staying power, then you're going to tough it out through challenges to get to what you want to get to, right? You have a 6-week dedicated period. If you're a person that is patient, you put in the work to get there, right? A person that is impatient is not going to put in the requisite amount of effort to get to the goal that they want to achieve, right? So I'll just encourage you, be a person that is patient. You'd be amazed by how far patience can take you in your relationships with your significant other, or with your kids, or with your coworkers, or with patients, right? Or in studying, or in taking exams. I'm telling you, patience is a virtue. Patience is, in fact, a virtue. I don't know why I kind of feel like that's something I want to kind of push out to the audience, right? Be a patient person. I promise you, it can really take you far in life. People that are patient, they tend to go a lot farther and a lot faster than people that are impatient. And sometimes you may think that a person that is patient is slow. No, those people are actually fast because their actions are measured. They don't take random actions. They take measured approaches to life. And they notice that, man, this person makes fewer mistakes, because those people that are impatient that seem to be going fast, they're going fast, but they're actually slow because they're making so many mistakes. So they spend huge chunks of their lives overcoming those mistakes that they made from impatience. But a person that is patient is making fewer mistakes, so they don't have to spend copious amounts of time overcoming errors that they've made, and they're able to just make very, very rapid progress. So again, I'll just encourage you, as you cap off the year, as you go into the new year, just make up your mind to be a person that is patient. Be a patient person, be a calm person, be a person of a patient, quiet, and calm spirit, and be amazed at how far you can go. So I'll see you in episode 501. God bless you. Have a wonderful holiday. Have a happy new year, and bye for now. Thank you.